Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to the festival's 2013 season, From Bach. This season, Music at Menlo celebrates Johann Sebastian Bach, the composer universally recognized as the greatest in Western music history. To the ears of many modern listeners, the canon begins with Bach, and in the 2.5 centuries since Bach's death, arguably every major musical innovation has borne his influence. Bach's legacy endures, whether in the craftsmanship of composers from Haydn to Mozart to Mendelssohn, in the sonic magnitude of Brahms, Bartok, and Shostakovich, and even in the sensual allure of Debussy, Richard Strauss, and George Gershwin. Audio Notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Music at Menlo's Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts. Concert Program 3, String Variations, illuminates the limitless splendor of the repertoire of music for string ensemble, as first realized by Bach in his effervescent Brandenburg Concerto No. 3, scored for trios of violins, violas, and cellos. One of the Baroque master's warmest sonic creations, the third Brandenburg Concerto invites listeners to revel in the luminescence of multiple string instruments. The lush sextet from Richard Strauss's opera Capriccio weaves an exquisite tapestry from one sinewy romantic line to the next, while Shostakovich's third quartet offers a more piquant perspective on the string literature. The program concludes with Mozart's Divertimento of 1788, a masterpiece for string trio as beguiling in character as it is epic in breadth.
Between 1718 and 1719, Bach had played for the Elector of Brandenburg in Berlin while negotiating the terms for a new harpsichord for the court at Köthen. About 2 years later, he would compose the magnificent Brandenburg Concerti, scored for varied assortments of instruments, and dedicate them to the Elector. The dedication reads,
"Sire, since I had the happiness a few years ago to play by command before your Royal Highness, and observed at that time that you derived some pleasure from the small musical talent that heaven has given me, and since, when I was taking leave of your Royal Highness, you did me the honor to request that I send you some of my compositions, I have therefore, in compliance with your most gracious demand, taken the liberty of tendering my most humble respects to your Royal Highness with the present concertos, arranged for several instruments, begging you most humbly not to judge their imperfection by the strict measure of the refined and delicate taste and musical pieces that everyone knows you possess, but rather to consider kindly the deep respect and most humble obedience which I am therefore attempting to show you. For the rest, sire, I beseech your Royal Highness most humbly to have the kindness to preserve your goodwill towards me, and to be convinced that I have nothing so much as a heart to be able to be employed on occasions more worthy of you and your service, since I am with matchless zeal, sire, your Royal Highness most humble and obedient servant, Johann Sebastian Bach. Curtain, March 24th, 1721."
In spite of this flowery dedication, the Margrave of Brandenburg, lacking the musical resources to stage a performance of the concerti, never thanked or paid Bach. But the works came to life nevertheless at Curtain, as Bach had deliberately suited them for the greater number of technically proficient musicians he had at his own disposal. The third Brandenburg Concerto is scored for 3 violins, 3 violas, and 3 cellos. Its particular instrumentation infuses the work with a rich sonority throughout its 3 movements. Cellist Lawrence Lesser.
It's a kind of a feast, in a way, and I think that often the challenge these days is not to make it sound like it was a feast a la Stokowski, but it's such joyous music, and when you get going with that, you're bouncing along and you really feel like you're riding a wave. Bach does all different kinds of things, and in that particular one, it's just such positive, radiating energy. It's just so much fun to play. Every part is important. Every part has its moment. If you're doing dum bum bum ba, later on you get da-da-dum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum. Everybody gets it.
Indeed, one of the most remarkable characteristics of the Third Brandenburg Concerto, a work composed in 1721, well before the viola and cello were regarded as soloistic instruments, is Bach's egalitarian treatment of the full ensemble. Throughout the first movement, melodic lines bounce around from player to player, at times giving the impression of a game of musical hot potato. In the score, the second movement is just one measure long, a simple two-chord Phrygian cadence, marked adagio. This is often realized in performance as an improvisatory cadenza.
And when the last movement comes, I don't know how fast we'll do it, but nobody's taking a lazy nap in the sun. It's not siesta time. I mean, it's really chugging along, and it's just so. Maybe the room he meant for it to be played in was very cold, so people felt they had to play very fast to get the energy.
With Bach's Third Brandenburg Concerto as its starting point, Concert Program 3 continues with works for string ensembles of various sizes over the following two centuries. Following the deaths of Richard Wagner in 1883 and Johannes Brahms in 1897, Richard Strauss became recognized as Germany's most important living composer. He was one of classical music's most acclaimed international celebrities over the first half of the 20th century. Though he composed across all significant genres, Strauss primarily established his reputation with his colorful operas and orchestral tone poems. Such lush, rapturous scores as Der Rosenkavalier, Also sprach Zarathustra, Metamorphosen, and other iconic works of the late Romantic period and early 20th century.
The thing about Strauss's music that speaks to me most is his use of harmony.
Violinist Sean Lee.
It's so adventurous and romantic and surprising and ultimately just wonderful and beautiful. I always think of his tone poems for orchestra and also his operas, and you just have these magnificent scores. He was really just a master of instrumentation. So I definitely think a lot about color and about texture.
Strauss composed Capriccio, the last of his 15 operas, between 1940 and 1941. It's one of Strauss's most interesting contributions to the operatic literature. It's an opera about opera. It's often described as a musical conversation piece, since its plot addresses questions about the nature of composition that preoccupied Strauss towards the end of his career. Specifically, it asks the question of which element of opera, music or poetry, is the greater art. The plot of Capriccio examines this question through the metaphor of a countess choosing between two suitors, a poet, Olivier, and a composer, Flamand. The opera begins with a scene in the Countess's chateau, where a newly composed string sextet by Flamand is being rehearsed. In fact, that sextet is a beautiful chamber work in its own right. It serves as a kind of overture to Capriccio, but is just as often performed independently, actually, in real life, as a piece of concert music, which is what it masquerades as in the world of the opera. What's immediately remarkable about the sextet, right from its opening measures, is the warm sonority created by the ensemble of two violins, two violas, and two cellos. The addition of a viola and cello to the standard string quartet makes for a rich, sensuous sound that appealed especially to composers in the Romantic period. Among the medium's finest examples are Brahms's two sextets, opuses 18 and 36, Tchaikovsky's Souvenir de Florence, and Schoenberg's Verklärte Nacht, all of which Strauss was surely familiar with. The Capriccio sextet, with its long-breath melodic lines and its luxurious harmonies, blissfully continues the tradition of that literature.
Capriccio, although it's written just for strings, I still think of the full orchestra because of the rich texture that it gets and the rich kind of sound that we want to play with to communicate his music in a way that I find effective.
The sextet being the curtain raiser for Strauss's last opera. Naturally, it also demonstrates the composer's keen dramatic instinct. A suddenly agitated section, set off by nervous tremolando and featuring impassioned recitative-like melodic lines, provides a stark contrast to the peaceful opening. Strauss also gives us dolorous arioso passages, which likewise suit the sextet's operatic setting. But even as it navigates a broad, expressive terrain, at the end of the day, the Capriccio Sextet is simply an enchanting work. In contrast to the operas Salome and Electra, among others of Strauss's hyper-expressionist scores that pushed conventional tonality to its limits, the tenor of the sextet is idyllic and serene, and perhaps, being one of Strauss's final creations, even wistful. The Russian pianist and composer Dmitri Shostakovich composed his String Quartet No. 3 in F major, opus 73, in 1946, in the wake of the Second World War. It was a sensitive time for Soviet artists of all disciplines. Following the revolution, Vladimir Lenin's populist ethos that art belongs to the people had been bastardized by the autocratic Stalin regime to justify co-opting the arts into Soviet propaganda. Stalin banned any avant-garde activity across the arts, the 12-tone music of the Second Viennese School, the modernist works of Bartok, and even most of Stravinsky's music were all seen as products of capitalist decadence and consequently forbidden. Shostakovich and his contemporaries were forced to respond in their music to the state's rigorous cultural demands. In 1948, the Communist Party published a resolution on the state of Russian music, which officially charged Shostakovich and other leading composers with, quote, anti-democratic tendencies that are alien to the Soviet people and its artistic tastes, and composing works strongly reminiscent of the spirit of contemporary modernistic bourgeois music of Europe and America, end quote. The resolution demanded that composers guilty of Western formalism reform their wayward artistry. Each had no choice but to publicly prostrate themselves before the government. Shostakovich wrote in response, quote, I am deeply grateful for all the criticism contained in the resolution. I shall with still more determination work on the musical depiction of the images of the heroic Soviet people, end quote. Though the Third Quartet was composed 2 years prior to the resolution, Stalin's attack on the artistic community had already begun, affecting writers, theater directors, and filmmakers in the years prior. Like much of Shostakovich's music, the Third Quartet has a strong narrative quality, suggesting an extra musical program. And indeed, Shostakovich is said to have originally given subtitles to each of its 5 movements. The subtitles implicate the work as a reflection on the experience of Soviet life during and following World War II. But given the social climate and the scrutiny his work would have been under by the authorities, Shostakovich was probably wise to withdraw even any suggestion of a political subtext. The Third Quartet ranks among Shostakovich's finest chamber works. It shows the composer at the height of his creative powers, featuring a range of thematic ideas and sonic textures to match its broad emotional compass. With the individual movement subtitles withdrawn, the quartet comes to us as a work of absolute music and shouldn't be understood as program music. That said, the supposed subtitles do concisely, if maybe inadequately, suggest the character of each movement. The first movement, Allegretto, was originally subtitled Calm Awareness of the Future Cataclysm. The exposition of this sonata form first movement is rife with melody and elegantly wrought, with its various musical ideas closely linked. Listen to this passage as Shostakovich nimbly extends the opening theme, revealing a mischievous streak to the theme's playfulness. A more sober second theme emerges. As with the first theme, Shostakovich deftly extends this second theme to show another dimension of its character. This time, a kind of manic unpredictability to go along with its somberness. Now, up to this point, the first movement seems innocently cast in classical sonata form, complete with a repeat of the exposition. But as the development section begins, the first theme dives unexpectedly into a thorny double fugue. The fugue proceeds in this fashion, constantly intensifying, until it reaches an agitated climax. Then, just melts into the recapitulation as if nothing had happened. The second movement was originally subtitled Rumblings of Unrest and Anticipation. The music turns to the steely key of E minor, close in proximity to the key of the first movement, F major, but harmonically very remote. The viola begins with a forbidding ostinato, while the first violin plays what sounds like a kind of grotesque folk dance. It's unsettling music, with the asymmetrical gait of the melody above that insistent ostinato. When the music shrinks to a whisper, with all four instruments playing staccato chords, pianissimo, and in rhythmic unison, the effect is even more unnerving. And as these menacing whispers continue, the grotesque melodies from earlier in the movement furtively return. The music slows, and the cello plays a transfiguration of the main theme, now slow and dolorous rather than aggressive. The movement ends quietly defeated. The second movement, essentially a scherzo, is answered by an even more diabolical scherzo in the third movement, originally subtitled The Forces of War Are Unleashed. Desperately sad adagio follows. Following the Forces of War, this movement was originally identified as the quartet's Homage to the Dead. The lower three strings begin the movement in stark octaves, a striking sonic contrast to the dense ensemble writing of the preceding movement. The first violin enters with a mournful melody, accompanied only by the second violin. The sudden loss of the lower two voices creates a feeling of hopelessness and desolation.
I think about Shostakovich in general, what I think is in his chamber music so astonishing is, relatively speaking, how few notes there are.
Cellist Lawrence Lesser.
And how everything is portrayed by those fewer notes. It isn't thin or anything, but sometimes it's spare. It's a little bit like you'd look at a drawing by the late period Matisse or New Yorker Saul Steinberg, who with one line can show everything.
The entire movement is based on the spare melodic materials introduced at the outset. But by voicing those ideas in different registers, couching them in different sonorities, Shostakovich endows the movement with great emotional weight.
The other thing is that Shostakovich's music is very true to feelings. He's a very emotional composer who in life was shy, but in his music never uncertain. What he wrote and he meant it to be there. And if it's playful, it's playful. And if it's crying or sad or whatever it is, it's that way too. And he's just so certain in his own gut about what it is he wants to say.
The movement ends with the quartet's loneliest music. The viola and cello seem devastated, emotionally numb. The music proceeds without pause to the final movement. The finale resembles classical sonata rondo form, a hybrid of sonata form, the structure of the first movement, and rondo form, in which a principal theme, or refrain, alternates with contrasting episodes. Shostakovich assigned the finale the heady subtitle, "The Eternal Question, Why and to What Purpose?" Befitting the audacity of such a far-reaching question, Shostakovich develops the main theme extensively throughout the movement, while offering a kaleidoscope of timbres and expressive characters in the richly varied episodes. The movement begins pensively, with the cello spinning a ruminative melody, accented by pizzicati and the viola. In the first contrasting episode, the first violin introduces a melancholy new melody above a hocketing staccato accompaniment in the lower strings. The music shifts in both tempo and character as the cello presents a lighthearted tune, reminiscent of the calm unawareness of the first movement. The main theme returns and builds in intensity towards loud, anguished cries in the violins. The viola and cello extend the refrain, full-throated in their upper registers. Thank you. This leads to a powerful return of the morbid theme from the Adagio, now presented in a shrieking fortissimo. The work soon concludes in a soft, ambiguous glow. Whether in peaceful repose or defeat is up to the performer's and listener's personal response. The eternal question, why and to what purpose, remains unanswered. Just as in Bach we have the apotheosis of the Baroque period, so does the music of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart represent the finest of the classical era. All of the musical values of that period are given their most perfect voice by Mozart. Viennese classicism valued the primacy of melody. Mozart's melodies are poetic, expressive, uncannily beautiful. His rich harmonies and instrumental textures are equally seductive. And as classicism moved away from the complexity of Bach's fugues towards more transparent forms, the effortlessness of Mozart's music belies its formal sophistication. These hallmarks of Mozart's language are in full evidence in the work that closes Concert Program 3, the Divertimento for String Trio in E-flat major. Mozart's Divertimento, composed in 1788, stands as one of the most revered masterworks of the string trio genre. And it's worth noting that the string trio is a particularly difficult ensemble to write for. Without the benefit of a second violin, the composer is left with limited options for distributing melody while filling out harmonies and textures. Numerous composers have tackled the medium, from Haydn, Beethoven, and Schubert, to Dohnányi, Hindemith, Schoenberg, and others in more recent eras. With the challenges of the medium and the pedigree of its composers in mind, then, it's noteworthy that many regard Mozart's Divertimento as the finest essay in the string trio literature. It's in six movements, and despite its innocuous designation as a divertimento and its modest instrumentation, the work contains music of great ambition. Its seeming simplicity masks its great melodic and harmonic inventiveness and highly evolved ensemble writing. The divertimento's melodic wealth is apparent right from the outset of the sonata form first movement. The first theme comprises a gentle lyrical melody, punctuated by excited ascending and descending scales. The second theme is equally affable. Here we encounter right away Mozart's deft approach to the string trio ensemble. The violin and cello give out the melody, while the viola actually serves as the bass, pacing the theme in its low register, below the cello. Listening throughout the work for the different ways in which Mozart deploys each instrument is one of the joys of this divertimento. The exposition closes with an inspired font of melodic ideas, each one seeming to just breathe inevitably into the next, as if spinning one long, effortless phrase. This seemingly infinite wellspring of melody, is one of the most miraculous elements of Mozart's genius. This movement's development section prods this aspect of Mozart's art further still, as the sunny thematic material of the exposition is reimagined in darker hues. Here's another example of the development section's imaginative treatment of material from the exposition. Mozart takes this ephemeral idea introduced previously and works it over with intricate counterpoint between the three instruments. In addition to Mozart's melodic genius, the Divertimento demonstrates the composer's mastery of instrumental texture. As the second movement adagio begins, the violin and viola employ frequent double stops, bowing two strings at once, to create a warm setting, alongside which the cello is free to take part in passing around the melody. The adagio is a thoughtful, introspective movement. Though built primarily on a single theme, Mozart exploits that theme to create a broad emotional spectrum. Soon, the violin assumes the ascending arpeggios first uttered by the cello, but now in a brighter register and fancifully ornamented. As in the first movement, Mozart has transfigured his seemingly straightforward melody to new expressive ends. The third movement, the first of two minuets, answers the pensive adagio with a newfound effervescence. The fourth movement is a theme in variations. The violin and viola present the winsome theme in octaves, giving it a textural transparency and space for the sonority to grow increasingly rich as the movement progresses. Four continuous variations follow. One noteworthy characteristic of the first two variations is not only the equal involvement of all three instruments, but especially the prominent role Mozart assigns to the viola, an instrument traditionally employed in a supporting role. A variation in B-flat minor casts the theme in a markedly different light. The viola heralds the music's return to B-flat major with a simplified version of the theme, piercing through staccato 16th notes in the cello and gleeful passage work in the violin. As the fifth movement, Mozart writes a second beguiling minuet. Mozart concludes his masterful divertimento with a playful finale. The finale is in sonata rondo form. The episodes that alternate with the refrain do more to complement than foil its cheerful demeanor. But drawing on the sonata form principle of thematic development, Mozart puts the main theme through its paces, revealing its deeper complexity as the movement proceeds. After further development of the theme and episodes of equal melodic richness, the divertimento arrives easily at a satisfying conclusion. Audio notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional narration is provided by Andrew Goldstein. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. J.S. Bach's Third Brandenburg Concerto is performed by Amy Lee, Joseph Silverstein, Jennifer Frauci, Mark Holloway, Paul Neubauer, Daniel Phillips, Fred Sherry, Nicholas Kanalakis, F.A. Bothsiegel, Kurt Morogi, and Anthony Newman, and appears courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Richard Strauss's Sextet, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Andrei Previn, Dmitri Shostakovich's Third String Quartet, Haydn String Quartet, Opus 20, No. 5, and Mendelssohn's Capriccio, Opus 81, No. 3, performed by the Emerson Quartet, appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's Divertimento, performed by the Leopold String Trio, Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, performed by Angela Hewitt, Shostakovich's Prelude and Fugue in E Minor, performed by Tatiana Nikolaeva, Claude Debussy's Preludes, performed by Stephen Osborne, and George Gershwin's Preludes, performed by Angela Brownridge, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. Mozart's Adagio and Fugue, performed by the Orion Quartet, appears courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Benjamin Britten's Prelude and Fugue for 18 Strings, performed by the English Chamber Orchestra and conducted by the composer, appears courtesy of Decca Records. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.